Hi, I'm Wayne McPhail, and I was one of the people that originally started the Rabble Podcast Network, and I think that you should support the Rabble Podcast Network and Rabble.ca because there's no other place where you're going to get such a diversity of voices speaking truth to power.
Show your support by going to www.rabble.ca/donate.
And welcome. You're listening to The Green Majority here at CIUT 89.5 FM, or possibly one of our wonderful and very appreciated community radio partners on the podcast or now on rabble.ca as well. You pretty much can't get away from us, Devin.
Yeah, we're like Enrique Iglesias. Well, and Ronnie D. Hyde can't escape our love.
If you are listening to media that is not directly funded or indirectly funded by massive corporations, there's a good chance you're going to hear us.
There you go.
Yeah. No, don't expect us on CBC anytime soon. So what we're going to be doing today is something really abnormal. We're going to be taking it easy a little bit today. So I've taken my boxing gloves off. Steph and I encourage you to take your boxing gloves off.
I had to bring them all the way here. You could have told me earlier.
I know.
But I'll survive.
Please. Also, Brenna is joining us.
Hey, everyone.
And we're going to take a little bit easy today. So we've been doing a lot of really heavy politics. It's unavoidable. But today I have a really special feature. So we had let me just tell a brief story about how we came into this. So I work for the Center for Social Innovation. So does Stefan. And pursuant to my duties while I was at work, I met a teacher. Her name is Leanne. And we got to a talking, and it turns out that she works with a bunch of students who were doing an environmental project. So they're turning claymation into little videos using iPads, and they were doing it on endangered species. So we got to a talking, and it turned out that it was going to work out that we were going to get them in here on the radio as a show. So they had a little contest, and the winners of the contest were going to come in. So they did that a couple weeks ago, and we're going to play that audio today. So I'm really not going to give it too much more of a setup. This is the teacher. I'll let the teacher, let Leanne, do the full introduction. And we'll listen to the kids, and then we'll come back and listen to it. Because there's three reasons I said we'd go ahead with this, and having listened to it. So the first one was, this is just neat. We don't get to do this very often. Let's stop. This is probably going to end up being the title of the show, but let's stop thinking of the children. Let's actually listen to them. We're going to do that this week. So that's one. Two, I thought they had some really interesting things to say that I think are worth unpacking a bit. And three, I wanted a week off from ranting. This is going to be a very calm show. So let's do that. We're going to go right into it. So this is, I'm not going to give it any further introduction. Let's just open our ears to some local kids. Let's go. We'll take it away with that.
Hi, my name is Liane Paixão. I'm a teacher at Holy Cross Catholic School. And during our first term, the theme of our unit was Protégeons l'environnement, let's protect our environment. And I wanted to give the students a final task that would be relevant, engaging, that would give them a chance to apply their French skills to address a real-world problem, and at the same time help them develop 21st century competencies and exercise citizenship. This seems to be quite an ambitious task, but it's not as unattainable as it may sound. And after some thinking and after getting a better sense of what my students' interests were, I came up with the idea of producing the Festival Cinéma Animé. So the festival is basically a 100% online animation contest that aims at promoting the French language while encouraging students to use tech skills to promote public awareness of environmental issues. This was the festival's first year, and we focused on Ontario endangered animal species. So over a period of 3 months, my grade 5-6 core French students worked in groups of two to produce 30-second animation / public announcements on an Ontario endangered animal of their choice. So besides learning French vocabulary and language structures they could apply to their project, they also learned about how to create a storyboard and how to shoot a stop-motion animation using iPads. Then the animations were posted online on a website where people could view and vote on their favorite production. And students were encouraged to use social media to spread the word about the site and try to get as many likes as possible. And besides receiving special certificates of participation as a prize, the producers of the two most voted animations would also have the honor to be here on the Green Majority Show talking about what they did and what they learned. So I would say that besides knowledge construction in terms of 21st century competencies, our biggest focus was the use of technology to support their learning and empower the kids to create something in response to a real issue that affects our environment, that affects us as a community. And now we're going to hear from the students who won first and second places at the festival.
Hi, my name is Jan, a grade 5 student from Holy Cross Catholic School. I'll be talking about the stop motion. So for me and Eden, it took a week or two to finish a 30-second stop motion. We had to retake 5 times, which made me and Eden panic. It was really funny. When we were making stop motion, it's really hard because you have to move the clay piece by piece and stuff and take pictures, and we only had like 30 minutes every day. One of my favorite things about the project was experiencing how to edit and make videos like people on YouTube and using those skills to create something that was useful, something that could help others learn about problems that affect our animals here in Ontario. The French name of the animal is Pauline Orange, and its English name is Orange Warbler. We chose that animal because our favorite animals are birds. We learned that the warbler eats insects, and it's found in Ontario, north of Ontario, near Lake Erie in the forest. The animal is endangered because their habitat is being destroyed. Eden and I's message in our animation was for people to preserve our forest and not to cut down our trees.
Hi, my name is Eden, and I'm a grade 5 student from Holy Cross Catholic School. The goal of this project was to help bring awareness of animals in Ontario that are endangered, and the reason they are becoming endangered is because that their habitat is being destroyed. And if one animal in our food chain is extinct, it affects everybody. It will affect us who are on top of the food chain. And we do want to have a world with living creatures, with plants and animals.
Hi, my name is Victoria Godino, and I'm a grade 5 student from Holy Cross School. During our first term, the theme of our French unit was l'environnement et moi, the environment and I, where we learned some basic facts about things that destroy our planet, like air pollution, toxic, and waste, and how we can help protect our planet, for instance, by recycling and reusing paper and plastic or buying green products. For that, the unit, our final project was about Ontario animal species that are endangered. So we had to learn about their habitats, then make an animation about some of the things that were threatening them. So in order to create the animation, first we had to do some research to create a 3-scene storyboard. The first scene was about the animal and its natural habitat. The second scene had to have one or two of the elements that were threatening it. And finally, in the third scene, we had to propose a solution. We also had to come up with a sentence in French for the narration encouraging people to take action and help protect the animal. Then we used plasticine and iPads to create our animation. It took us about a month. I thought the project was a good idea because we got to learn about animals we didn't even know were endangered or threatened. I learned that we need to protect them because their extinction could affect us, since we're all connected and we could help change the world, even if we're not adults. My animation was about the barn owl, and it's important to protect animals like the barn owl because they haven't done anything to us. So why should we harm them? If I could take this project farther, I would probably want to raise money and do more to help the barn owl because everyone and everything matters.
Hello, my name is Ruel, and I'm in grade 6.
And I'm Jason, also in grade 6.
Jason and I worked together in a French animation project. We chose to do our project on the wood turtle. Through this project, we learned a lot of things about the species that we didn't even know existed.
We learned that the wood turtle prefers clear rivers, streams, or creeks with a slight current and sandy or gravelly bottom, and that it prefers to live in wooded areas, but they also found in other habitats such as wet meadows, swamps, and fields.
We also learned some interesting facts, like, for instance, wood turtles are one of the few kinds of Ontario turtles that do not need to be underwater to swallow their food.
We found all those facts on the website of the Ontario Ministry of Natural Resources, which had information about endangered species in Ontario. Then our teacher showed us how to create a storyboard using the French vocabulary we had to learn in class.
After we put together the storyboard with the sentences and drawings of our three main scenes, we had to create an animation, which would be shared online.
So the goal of our animation was to make people aware of the dangers that were threatening the survival of the wood turtle. Unfortunately, Ontario's wood turtle are at risk mostly because of the loss of its habitat.
Once we were done with the animation, which took us a pretty long time to create, our teacher posted everyone's production on a website, and we got to share our work with everyone. Not only with our classmates, but with anybody who around the world that clicked on our link. I'm glad I was able to do this project because I learned many skills I may use in the future, like claymation. I also learned more about this species, what it likes, what it eats, where it lives, etc. My experience of this was like a roller coaster. At first, I was pretty sad that we had this big project due, but then I had fun with it when we were making the claymation. And now I'm here at a radio show where hundreds or even thousands of people could be listening to me. And that's why I'm so glad to have been able to experience this.
I'm glad too, because if we didn't finish this animation, we couldn't go on this radio station. So we had troubles with the animation. The characters kept on falling, and I learned a lot from this animation and the wood turtle, like where it lives and how hard it is to do animation.
All right. So, comments, Brenna.
That makes me want to thank my grade 7 teacher in ecology and biology, and took us out on outdoor ed classes and things like that, because I think clearly this single teacher is like making these kids think like the one we can make a difference even though we're not adults.
Yeah. So I think the first thing that we have to say, of course, was thank you to all of the kids, and thank you to Leanne Paxow from the Holy Cross Catholic School. It was a real pleasure to have them in, and we're happy to do it again. So we'll take this opportunity as well. If there's other teachers doing cool things and you want to send us an email, feel free to do that. But let's talk a little bit about what they were talking about. So there was a few things in there. Of course, there was a key line talking about, I think that there's a few things I want to unpack, but of course the first one was just the idea of, well, what did we do to them? And that's great. And I think that's the sort of thing where, you know, people who like, you know, the people in the studio and, you know, who sort of work in this area go, yeah, exactly. Like that's not our entire point, but that's part of it. And that's sort of that's sort of where this stuff comes from, is it's from a sense of empathy of, you know, we should be not worried about just ourselves. And I sort of feel like I you know, sad that I have the job of possibly informing the kids who are likely listening right now that unfortunately that's not how everybody thinks. But the good news is they're wrong and you're right. And I just want you to know that. There was one thing I just wanted to talk about that, with that, which was the idea of, and not necessarily with reference to exactly what the kids were saying, but this idea of childishness and people using that as an insult.
Right.
And so kids are allowed to be childish because they're saying you're kids. But there's a little bit of what people mean by that. And when people say things are childish, there's two different things they mean by that. One of them was what they means is that it's a very simplistic understanding of something. Generally, if you hear an adult say that to you, I'm just addressing the kids now. If you hear an adult say that to you, they're not necessarily trying to insult you, but what they're trying to say is that you don't have a full understanding of something and they're trying to be polite. But in this case, they're wrong. In this case, they're wrong. You do have the full understanding of something. All of the rest of the baggage that's on top of that is the complication factor that gets adults confused. So as you grow up, you know, you're going to learn a lot of other things. You're going to change your mind about a lot of things, but it should still remain informed by this stuff. You have the correct understanding. It's the adults who got distracted, and don't you dare lose it because you're right. And don't let anyone tell you that you're wrong. That's my comment. Stefan.
I just love the idea of the kid test to some extent. You know like just the idea of like if you ask why over and over and over again until you get to another, it's like it's the kid test. You know, like so specifically on the one little girl's point about trying to protect the animals because what do you do to them? Like what I love about that is like I'm going with my head. What would response be? Well, it was like, well, we're not actually out to hurt the barn owls. We just needed to have, you know, we just destroyed their habitat to build this thing. Why? Well, because people needed to live in houses. Why? Well, because like, you know, like why build them there? Well, because of this. And it's sort of like this. You get to this point where you're like, at some point, you're like, well, because of the economy.
Yeah.
Or so as, because jobs. And you get to these weird high level things, right? You get to these high level concepts really quickly. As trying to explain to these, you know, and like, yes, of course, there's going to be, you know, like there are now 7 billion humans on the planet. You know, there will be more habitat destruction than if there were not 7 billion, which there were, you know, hundreds of years ago. So at some point, there's some truth to the fact that humans will inherently have to encroach on things. But then sort of the idea of like, well, why aren't we doing everything to be as limited? Like, why aren't we doing our best to not hurt other things?
Yeah,
is where you sort of fall apart into this sort of like you have to basically say because I don't want to. Like that's eventually you get to that point. Eventually, get to the point is like, well, we just didn't feel like it was going to be worth it, so we didn't do it.
Yeah. So, and I mean that's the thing, and that I want to my lesson moment, I guess, for the kids that may be listening, as well, is that, you know, if you say, you know, if you talk about this or if you talk about, you know, the climate or protecting the environment or protecting endangered species. And something, and somebody says to you, and likely this will be an adult that will say this to you, say, well, you know, you'll understand when you're older. What I want you to say to them is, maybe, but are you sure you aren't rationalizing? Hmm. Maybe you'll have to go look that word up. Maybe.
Yeah, I'm not sure if these kids are.
No, but like the concept is important because that's what Stefan was talking about, right? Because when we get, you know, when adults grow up and they get busy and they have, you know, jobs and family, they get very distracted. And so there's problems that are complicated. And just because you grow older doesn't mean you get answers to those problems. And so as people grow up, many times what they do is they'll do something called rationalizing. And what that basically means is it's a very fancy word for saying, I don't have an answer to that, and not having an answer or the answer that seems true at a very basic level to be right is inconvenient. So I'm going to find a way to make it not true. So when you say, well, barn owls aren't hurting us, so why are we hurting them? You say, well, you don't understand economics. okay, that's true, but you're also rationalizing, which is that doesn't change the fact that we shouldn't be hurting other species, and it's just too complicated for you, so you're going to pretend it's not a problem, or you're going to say it's not important, or you're going to say you'll understand when you're older. That's a way of avoiding the perfectly valid question, why are we harming other life? And if they tell you anything about you'll understand later, tell them they're rationalizing, even if you don't entirely know what that word means, because you'll be correct.
I think a little bit too, childishness can be conflated with idealism or optimism.
Yes.
And if that's the case, I would much rather be childish than a pessimist.
Well, look at all the attacks on you know, Bernie Sanders, all the attacks from mainstream media, and largely the people who are going to have their taxes increased. Let's remember this, that the people that are trying to dismiss Bernie Sanders are the very people that are probably going to get a tax increase. That's why they're telling you it's bad, because they're going to lose money, not you, them. Right. So they have an incentive to give you misinformation about that. And that's a lot of the way that's what it is you're going to make my life harder, so I don't want to acknowledge that you have a valid point of view. And the fact is that, you know, we're well into this system, and it has a lot of things, and it's hard. Like, you know, people say it's like when I took my urban studies class, you know, be like, well, the reason we don't have any class on how to design a perfect city when you do urban studies is because that's a situation you are never in. It's useless. It's a thought experiment, but practically it's useless, because you always have to work with what you've got. We've developed about as much land on this planet as let me rephrase that. We're well past developing the amount of land on this planet that is safely beyond the safe limits of how we can balance, you know, with our natural environment. We're well past the safe limits of that. So there's really not going to be many opportunities to design the perfect city from scratch. We have to work with what we've got. But at the same point, I don't think it's I don't think it's practical to sort of talk about, you know, what would be in an ideal scenario. So if we got to wipe the board clean. But at the same point, I think what we have to do if you're trying to solve a problem is you have to talk about the actual causes of that problem, right? And so that's why we're saying, and that's maybe we'll get into Rex Murphy a little bit later, maybe we won't. But that's sort of what I don't understand about, you know, so much of the misunderstanding about these conversations about oil infrastructure in Canada is be like, well, you're anti-oil there, and Albertans, and mainly Albertans, get jobs from oil. Therefore, if you're anti-oil, you're anti-Albertans. Mm-hmm. And wait, so who are you saying is the childish one now? That seems like a really simplified... that's a simplification of an understanding of problem. We have a problem. The problem is there's carbon in the atmosphere. We are producing something that's really carbon intensive. So the fact that people are employed in that industry, does that take everything off the table? So great. Okay, so we learn that something we're pumping into the air, or something we're putting in the water, is poisoning everyone, and it's going to give everybody cancer. But it employs a lot of people. Guess we can't do anything about it.
Well,
it's a silly argument. It's a silly argument, and it's usually the people making that argument that are the first to accuse others of not understanding or needing to grow up. And it's just so frustrating.
Well, there's an immediate example of that. To my knowledge, they might have stopped in the last couple of years. Canada still produces, mines, and sells asbestos.
Yeah.
Like, we've banned it. We know it kills people. Yeah. And yet we're exporting it still.
Yeah.
We might have stopped in the last 2 years. I haven't followed up on this. But, like, talk about something that everyone accepts. Like, if you have asbestos in your house, you have to, have these, like, it's a massive health hazard.
It's a biohazard.
It's a huge thing.
Yeah.
And yet it employs a bunch of people, and therefore we must keep doing it.
Yeah.
It's like, what did everyone else who were selling asbestos do to us?
Yeah. So we're a little past where we normally take a break there, but I was just enjoying the conversation. So maybe we'll just to wrap up, and we'll go to Alex now, who's going to introduce our music break here. Just by way of saying was that, you know, as a recap, we're absolutely happy to have the students of Holy Cross Catholic School come in. I think that they had a devastatingly accurate understanding of what's going on, and I encourage them to continue the good work. And maybe we'll hear from them again. But thanks so much for that. We're going to come back in just a moment and talk about a little bit more news here on the Green Majority you're listening to currently. If you're listening live, you're listening on CIUT 89.5 FM. You could also be listening on the podcast, off the website, on rabble.ca, or at many other of our community radio partners across the country. If you're listening on the podcast, though, there's a bonus show, just to remind people. So you get a little bit extra content if you subscribe to the podcast. But without further ado, Alex.
Thanks, Darren. I want to talk about the Wavelength Music Festival that's coming up this weekend in Toronto. It's happening tonight through to Sunday, February 12th to February 14th. And the Festival HQ is going to be at the Garrison, Dundas West. And I wanted to play a couple bands today that are performing at Wavelength Music Festival, including my own, Versa, which we're going to hear from second. But this first one is Merganser. It's a Toronto-based violinist and her experimental pop project. So this is a song called Mirror Maze, and it just came out a couple months ago. And Merganser's on tomorrow, Saturday, at 4:45 at Markham House.
And we're back. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Darren Kaster, which I forgot to say, I realized earlier. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT with Darren Kaster. Stefan Hostetter's here as well with me.
Hi, Dan.
And Brenna Owen, who's in the studio. We have a slightly reduced crew. We've had a very big crew in the studio, so it feels a bit empty today, even though there's three of us in here. But a few of our co-hosts will be back soon as well. So don't worry, those additional voices are still around. But for now, I'm gonna hand it over to Stefan because you have some prepared thoughts, I understand.
Yeah, well, so in last week's bonus show, Sabina, who hasn't been on the regular show, but one of our co-hosts who we're working with right now, asked a very simple question. And what I was interested by the question was it was very earnest. Because she just listened to our entire show about the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And I'm sorry, children, if you're still listening, I'm going to say that word a bunch. And so you get to learn about trade deals.
You're welcome to listen, but here's where you'll be forgiven for turning
Yes,
for
exactly.
Turning
although there is a whole bit about childishness and seriousness that I'm going to get to. But it was a very earnest question. She was very, very... It wasn't one of those things where it was like, often people ask a question and it's just more of a statement. And the question was, why would anyone support this? And most often you hear that from someone, what they're stating is, I don't support this, not an actual question. I tried to answer it last week and I didn't think I did a good enough job. And so I wanted to actually try to better answer it this week. And the way it ties into seriousness and childishness is that what I wanted to call this piece was that the environment isn't serious business. Because as I looked into this, looked into the TPP, some things became very, very clear. The first is there are a whole bunch of economists who supported NAFTA, which included a whole bunch of things that are part of the TPP, that people are currently driving by the TPP, but also was in NAFTA, who have actually switched sides and moved away from the TPP while still supporting NAFTA. And that fascinated me alone. Paul Krugman is on this list. Joseph Stiglitz is on this list. A bunch of the sort of democratic economists have moved away, and yet the leaves of the people who are pitching for it are all the reason why they're trying to sell it is also very interesting. So the reason why the original point is that this trade deal the TPP specifically, and to some extent NAFTA, but much more TPP. Isn't really actually about free trade. Almost every argument I've found about it doesn't really touch too much on free trade. That's the guise, but there's a fascinating article that was released by someone who used to work for the Obama administration about this deal. And in it, he basically went through all of these problems with the deal, but then ended up basically making a case that what it really is foreign policy. That the TPP isn't so much a trade deal as it is foreign policy, and that the administration and the United States government has actually failed in a couple other attempts to be more involved in global trade. They're not a part of this of an Asian bank that China's a part of, and that this really is a pushback against China's power within the global sphere.
I just want to jump in for a minute because I like the way you put that. So as an illustration, because you know that my whole gimmick is metaphor and whatnot, comparison would be NATO, right? Except it's instead of a military alliance, it's a corporate alliance. But it still very much functions like NATO does, right? It's a group of countries that theoretically have agreed to back each other up, although apparently we've seen occasionally that there's a little more complicated than that. But this is very much the same, except instead of governments whose primary concern is to keep the peace or at least have a unified force to try and create peace by intimidation of like, don't mess with us because all our buddies are with us. Mm-hmm. Except that it's not governments, it's corporations that are doing it. And I think that it's, you know, their motives are very different and your motives matter.
Right. So just to read that back a little bit, this was largely talked about by corporations, and corporations really what's interesting about this deal was it was really actually built up as a bunch of small groups within every single country making their case for their particular weird thing, and the full text is so long, and in it you might have like four lines that really really matter to one industry, and that was their entire reason of being there, and four lines for someone else, and so you get this massive conglomerate of business.
It's the Harper Omnibus trick. Let's put 4,000 things in there, and three of them are the one that we actually are really trying to, but we know that there's going to be negative repercussions to them. So let's go get some creative writer to write a bunch of nonsense for 300 pages about things that don't really matter so we can sneak this in the middle of it. It's also like putting a pill in a strawberry and feeding it to your dog.
But the real point of these sort of these like it built up people supporting it, and it's also fascinating to read the people who don't support the TPP. To my understanding, Ford still doesn't support it, and there are a bunch of large corporations who don't support it because there isn't the right protections for them. The tobacco industry hates it because we carved out of the deal, and you go through all these sort of things about how. What this really is, and it's interesting, there's a certain level of it which is just reducing tariffs, and there's all these different tariffs that are being reduced, but it's not what an economist would really want to see. If economists really wanted to have a good free trade deal, everyone would just unilaterally drop all their tariffs and then just let it run amok. And because that's the most simple way to reduce protectionism without sort of having this sort of vested interest that exists. But the world is way too complicated for that. And in one of the articles that's written by the previous Obama president, he said that like one of the reasons why you can't do that is like Japan is really has a historic attachment to rice farms, so they will never reduce their tariffs on imported rice. So for example. And so what this ends up being is a conglomerate of little gives and takes from all these different industries. And it's a very specific and so people all across these places will – like there's a certain number of people all across the world will support it. And what's also interesting is that like I want to just go into two of the things that are sort of activists' main contention points and then explain why to some extent the argument against those two things. The first is that – well, how could you support this if you didn't? If all these things so they're going to be moving jobs, we'll lose jobs. Trade deals aren't really about jobs. And what's fascinating about this is that when you read the sort of economist arguments, their basic understanding is that the control of different the government has so much more other types of ways to increase and decrease job control that losing 50,000 jobs because of a trade deal is so minor. In comparison to the control that its country has, that argument doesn't even factor in for an economist's understanding. Mm. And the second one is more which we talked about a bunch is the sort of understanding of investor state suing each other. And basically, is, you know, corporations can sue the governments. And what's also fascinating is the reason why they're in place, or the pitch about why they're in place, which I think needs to be aired, is not so much to help, not so much for the large companies or the large countries, because large countries A, don't get sued that much, B, are way bigger than you really fully understand. Like I looked this up, Canada's country, which is relatively, you know, we're a medium sized country, I think. We are about 4.5 times bigger than the biggest company in the world. You know, like if you just presumed all companies were countries, you're looking at about the largest.
An argument I could make,
yeah,
for another show.
Well, for sure, the largest company, Walmart, is about the size, has about the same output as Norway, and Canada is about four times that size. So to some extent, you know, it's as much as we can be framed as big companies versus the people, countries still have a level of overt power that is proven. And to go down from that, when you talk about the number of what's interesting is to watch economists are so sort of blasé about investor state solution, suits, because of the fact that when you look at sort of the point of them, which is fascinating, is that the goal is that with these pieces in place, the goal is to actually drive investment into smaller countries, because the reason why they weren't being invested in the first place is that the government would suddenly do something random like we are now own the oil industry, which Venezuela has done. And so the companies won't invest because they're concerned of that kind of thing. That sort of obvious overt power that anyone would accept is not should not be done by a state. You know, state, as much as we sort of don't want corporations, we just don't think that a state should just come in and say, like, we now own your business, goodbye. I think most people would accept that. If you're a communist, you should think we should do exactly that. But
understanding the usual, in most cases, most of the time, asterisk.
Exactly. Yes. Of course. And so that's the goal. What's fascinating about this is the goal is to actually drive investment in these slower states to give the companies actual assurances that they won't be hurt by these sort of things. And then we take it sort of like, well, it's attack on democracy on the other side. And expanding that is a slippery slope. Really, it's the slippery slope argument is the strongest we're going to come up with, because even under NAFTA, we've been sued the most times, which is often quoted. What isn't quoted is that that's 35 times. And to my understanding, we've lost once, which is like, again, and the United States has never lost and only been sued 11 times. So for us, like, and what's offensive is these things are so much like, as it always is, it's way less important for us, the big people, than the small countries that are getting involved in this, because they're the ones who really actually can't afford to fight back. Mm-hmm. Whereas, if there was a really egregious violation, we could pretty easily put our foot down. And of course the concern is that, as more you expand, then at some point you get a tipping point, at that point it's too late, which is obviously a fully valid argument. But I think it's important to at least get to that part.
All right. So, Yeah. So I had a couple quick things. We're getting close to where we should take a second break. Did you want to finish up a thought?
Yeah, for sure. So what I want to get back to after this, with all that understanding, I want to sort of get back to. Well, say you now accept these things or know these thing more things, but you want to really, but it's still, you think it's a bad thing. Why is it still a bad thing? And what's fascinating is, why were these economists who were on side of NAFTA now against the TPP, which I think is really the conversation we need to understand. And what it comes down to is the IP protections, intellectual property protections. Those are the things, and those extensions, and the idea that this isn't a free trade deal, but really a chance to expand some of these other interests and expand. Really, honestly, the government is seeing corporate government, like corporate America is still America, is sort of the pitch. Like, as we said last week, and I'm going to say it again, when Doctors Without Borders /MSF, they're the same company, or same nonprofit /charity, are against something, listen. Because they don't really take political stances. They're very intentionally not political, and yet they come out against this one specific thing.
That's the without borders part.
Yes, exactly.
Doctors Without Borders.
Yeah, exactly. I think that these extensions of this intellectual property, especially on drugs, but all throughout the whole thing, is the Achilles heel of the TPP. And if we're going to win, to some extent, I think we need to tone down some of our other rhetoric and just become a microphone for the people who sort of have this sort of like, it's literally killing people or will kill people argument, because it's very accurate and is the reason why even economists are sort of backing away from this deal. Mm. And so that's what I wanted to end on, was this idea that if we're going to be attacking the TPP, yes, we need to understand all the other things, but I really think that intellectual property is the place where it is the weakest, and is where it's already losing economists on one side and killing people on the other side. So if it's going to go down, it's going to go down on IP laws. And so I think as environmentalists, the strongest thing we can do is back that up and become a microphone for the arrow to some extent to that Achilles heel.
Thank you, Stefan. I largely agree. And as I said, we should move on to a break, and we're going to keep talking about this. But just a couple of thoughts and literally sort of teases for maybe things we could come back to another time. One of the things to think about in addition to that was, how many of these rules are one directional?
right? So, for instance, there's limited liability. When we have a pipeline spill or an oil spill or anything like that, there's a limit. There are laws in place to limit how much liability a company can do. And guess what? The public pays for the rest of it. And guess what further? In most cases, it's less than half. The taxpayer pays more. Again, in most cases, most of the time, the taxpayer pays more, significantly more in many cases, than the company who caused the problem in the first place. So somebody can cut corners, save costs, create a giant environmental disaster, cost tons of money. The public pays more for it. And guess what? Here's the kicker. Because the country spent money, GDP goes up, even though we spent that money to clean up an environmental disaster that's hurting the citizens. That makes it look like the economy is doing better. So what I'm wondering is, you know, people should be wondering about them is, okay, we can have – there's two conversations you can have here. You can have a conversation about should these powers exist? Should there be such things as limited liability? And the other question to have is, okay, regardless of what types of rules we decide are good rules, what argument can you make for only one of those two parties having those powers? And further to that point, why would you – under what circumstance would you ever say that a multinational corporation should have powers that governments don't, that allow them that give them more power than governments? Because essentially you're saying that you believe that companies whose only legal requirement is to maximize profit should be in a more powerful position than maybe an imperfect, maybe it's really, you know, maybe there's a lot of waste, maybe we, you know, there's all sorts of problems with government, but at least their intention is to at least it's set up to try to protect people. Maybe it doesn't do a good job very often, but at least that's its intention versus giving power saying, okay, well, it's not very efficient at that job. So let's take power away from that institution and give it to someone whose job is something that is completely divorced from that and is frequently in conflict with that. And that's the part of this, just I don't want to say emotional because that sort of makes it seem like this is a vapid point. It's not. At its core, we're talking about two different parties and trading power between them. And we're taking one that's imperfect, but at least is designed to protect and help us, and giving it to someone who has a motive to not do that in almost all cases. And I think that's really what it comes down to. And we need to be having a discussion about, should anyone have these types of powers? And if they do, what's your argument for someone for giving it to corporations and taking away from countries? It's really that simple. And we can get into the weeds, we can get into the details and all that stuff. And the other thing I'll just do as a throwaway, we'll come back to it later, is that a lot of the time, you know, where this the money issue comes in, maximizing profit, blah, 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 is playing currencies off each other, right? And that's where a lot of these markets have. So just as a thought experiment, just think for a minute, what would happen if we just had one global currency? Not global government, just one global currency, and there was no money could be made by simply making bets for and against individual countries. What kind of a world would that be? Interesting. Maybe we'll come back to it. Brenna, do you have a quick thought before we go to break?
No.
No. Okay.
Not,
so we'll
not
we'll,
till afterwards.
we'll lead with you when we come back to
sure.
The break. So you're listening to the Green Majority, very sort of relaxed, but also very philosophical today, here at CIUT 89.5 FM, or one of our wonderful community radio partners all the way across the country, now in the U.S. as well, on the podcast, as well as on rabble.ca, on the podcast, Rabble Podcast Network. But without further ado, we're going to go back to Alex, who's going to tell us about our second and final music break. Alex.
Thanks, Darren. So yeah, we're just talking about the Wavelength Music Festival this weekend, and a bit of shameless self-promotion. My band Versa is performing at the festival. We're performing Saturday, February 13th at 8 p.m. So yeah, check out our song Waited Long Enough. Here it is.
Right, we are back. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. We're running a little tight on time. We've been having such a sort of a relaxed show here. We've been a little bit neglectful of the clock. So, well, I'm not going to apologize. We had fun. Sticking to it. Good show. Brenna, however, has been mostly silent for a large part of the show today. So, Brenna, I'm going to leave basically the last section to you. So go ahead.
Well, I've been pestering Darren, actually, because I really would like to talk a little bit about this Rex Murphy op-ed, I guess, in CBC. I have a few bones to pick with this opinion. You know, the most significant of one is that he points to dim-minded celebrities, including David Suzuki, the David Suzukis and the Neil Youngs.
Oh, sorry, I just want to jump in. So if you're listening and you're not sure what Brenna's talking about, just stop. If you're listening on a podcast, stop right now and go read the article that's posted on the website.
Read
anyway,
at the same time.
The name of the article is Rex Murphy on Calgary, Where Are the City's Allies?
Yes. So I apologize. So he points to the Neil Youngs and then says Neil Young compared working in the oil patch to Hiroshima. And then below this is a picture of Neil Young speaking at a conference for Honor the Treaties in 2014. And I'm wondering who decided to have Rex Murphy be so critical of Neil Young in one sentence and then literally right below it show Neil Young speaking about the rights of indigenous people, something that is not mentioned in Rex Murphy's entire piece.
Yeah, well, I hope it is. So it's probably the answer is honestly probably the person who made this web thing Google searched very quickly their archives of pictures and just chose one at random. It's more fun to think that they're messing with Rex Murphy.
That's possible. But yeah, we did have also some vote for the news thing as well. So I know we're actually gonna. So if you're listening on the radio, we have the bonus show. You listen to that on the podcast. You can subscribe on iTunes, or you can go to greenmajority.ca/podcast to find it. So we're actually gonna come back to the Rex Murphy thing in the after show here, but just in the final few minutes, and I'll go back to Brenna again for first comment. But just we have a thing called Vote for the News, and you go onto the website. It's greenmajority.ca/vote, or just there's a big button that says Vote for the News, and we put up some articles we don't have time to get to, and people will let us know that they wish we had gotten to it, and we come back to it. So one of them was just talking about nuclear power, which we haven't talked about in a little while, but it's a very comprehensive article with a number of sources here talking about, you know, because it's still coming up, the idea of you know, nuclear power being the only way to deal with climate change. And we've done a number of really good interviews. Dr. Gordon Edwards came on and explained why this is not true. I mean, the most simple reason why it's not true is he was said, well, it takes about 8 to 10 years to build a new reactor, and we don't have that long. And the amount of renewable energy you can build in that time, it doesn't take 8 years to get online. It comes online almost immediately. So by the time the nuclear reactor comes on, maybe it even would be producing slightly more energy than the amount of renewable you could build in that time, which that's not even necessarily true. In fact, I think it's likely not true. But you also missing the fact that you've been generating renewable energy the entire time, like for the majority of that 8 years, not just at the 8 years when it's completed. So that's one of the reasons. But the other main reason here is one of the big myths about nuclear power, which is that it is one of the biggest sucks of public money ever. There has never in the history of Canada been a single nuclear power project that has ever come in on budget, and not even close. We're talking by like tens of millions and more dollars. It is heavily subsidized. They get all sorts of public loophole breaks. It is one of the most ridiculous cash holes in the history of this country. And that's without even getting into the safety issue here. So let's take a moment and talk about nuclear energy and the idea that it is not cheap. I mean, the famous line that likes to get thrown around was that these things when it was first coming around, which would be that nuclear power would be power so cheap to meter. And that is the opposite of true. And yet it looks like we're just about to do a whole bunch of refurbishment here. So, I mean, let's leave even the safety thing for aside a minute here. And let's just talk about the relevance of subsidies. And you know, we spend so much money subsidizing oil, and we spend so much money subsidizing nuclear. And there's almost no relative subsidy for renewable energy. And it's still almost reaching parity. I mean, it's so frustrating. That's all I'll say for now.
Well, I think what's interesting about it is that what's fascinating is a sort of ongoing idea that that nuclear will be the savior, and I think it comes down to really two things. There's a whole subsidies conversation, which I'm going to leave for Brenna, but the what I find fascinating is the length of which you can understand nuclear as our savior. I think comes down to two sort of things. The first is an overt lack of imagination. From a grid standpoint, you know, we've been releasing these climate cartoons from time to time. Another one's going to come out soon.
Which is about the
hard path and soft path energy systems. And what it really comes down to is this idea that nuclear fits within our understanding of how energy generation works. You know, nuclear is a very simple way. In planning people's minds, you put it exactly where you had the coal fire power plant. It generates the energy, and you use the same system. It fits perfectly into our current existing energy grid, which is very massive. You put a massive nuclear power plant somewhere, and then you distribute the energy everywhere. It's very, you know, it's it, energy is one place, energy generation is one place, energy use is another place. They're not connected, and just go for it. And so and nuclear fits so well within the narrative, and there's a lack of imagination on society's part to understand that renewables could generate energy. It just wouldn't look like that. You know, even when we see renewables, really, we have renewables generating them in that sort of hard path energy way. We create solar farms and wind farms, which is to some extent forcing a technology that does not require that sort of treatment into our old leaders because we just don't have the way to think about it. And the second, I think, is that there's just this level of obsession with the idea that nuclear power just sounds cool. Right,
yeah.
It's just like it's the future. The word nuclear is in it.
It's the future in the way that Back to the Future was the future. Like it's a very old understand. It's a very very old understanding of what futurism looks like.
Right, for sure. But it's still. I think it's because it has a sort of massive generation possibility of, you know, you still feel that sort of sense to, like, it's like, you know, it could be the silver bullet. Everyone wants the silver bullet. People don't want to improve in increments. Mm-hmm. Renewable is an incremental solution, whereas nuclear silver bullet, you want to do that. Yeah.
So Stefan, you might almost say that if someone wanted to learn more about that, they could watch something called Climate Cartoons.
I would say that, yes.
Yes, which can be found at greenmajority.ca.
Nice plug.
Thank you. Brenna?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you guys covered kind of the subsidies and the economics about nuclear, but my one kind of point would be it's still trying to find a solution that can sustain our current consumption levels, and we're not looking at any type of lifestyle changes. You know, it's not making way for changes to the way we consume in a capitalist system. So I think that merits pointing out, although I know that we're just talking more about like the economic case for moving away from nuclear.
Mm. Well, I mean, it's kind of like this thing of someone, you know, who's maybe morbidly obese, you know, in a way that is not, you know, the cause of an otherwise health issue, but just someone who just for a long time has an incredibly poor diet and something where in a situation of somebody being in this case where it is actually their fault. Right, as opposed to other health, you know, issues and impacts, and going to them and saying, "Well, you know, what can I do, doc? You know, you've told me I have all these heart concerns and that I'm at great risk for a heart attack." And be like, "Well, you could, you know, change your diet." And, well, okay, so you could eat, and I'm just simplifying here, but you're like, "Well, you could try eating salads. There's great, you know, not even just lettuce. There's, you know, beans and all these things, but whatever." And they're like, "Okay, well, it's great, but I don't really like the taste of it. So can you come back to me when you've got a salad that tastes like pizza and hamburgers?" And you're like, "No. You just what you're doing is not okay." And it's not about taking the thing, making the thing that you want okay for you. You're going to have to change. And there's really, and again, to come back to this, you know, to close full circle, it's a very childish attitude to say, I don't want to change. You have to change reality to suit my preferences as opposed to the other way around. And yet frequently we're, and by we I mean environmentalists, are the ones who are accused of having a childish understanding of the world. The Rex Murphy article is one of the most childish displays of ignorance ever. And they make a big point of, like, look at all his accreditation and he went to all these honors. I'm sure there's a number of things on which Rex Murphy is an absolute authority. And I'm sure he's very, very good at many things. I don't think he's stupid. But he's completely hundreds of miles astronomically out of his league here when he's talking about these issues, and it needs to be pointed out. And I think it's absolutely irresponsible to put him on the air to talk about something that he is demonstrably misinformed about and talk as if, well, that's Rex Murphy. That's Rex Murphy's opinion. Yeah, that's about as much. I want to hear about as much about climate change from Rex Murphy as I do about Beyonce on climate change.
I actually
their opinion is
Beyonce
irrelevant. In fact, there's a good chance that Beyonce has more intelligent things to say than he would. We've got about 3 minutes.
Yeah, I was going to actually jump back because Brett made the point about how nuclear power still allows us to consume the same amount. And I think that actually ties actually perfectly back into the entire conversation about our energy systems and energy grids
and climate cartoons.
And climate grids. Exactly. excellent plug again. Because really what's fascinating about the difference is that when you're looking at nuclear power and the reason why nuclear power fits into our system so well is that it's part of this separation of energy generation and energy consumption, and it's not a part of this sort of a smart intelligent grid that is the goal of which is to actually just ensure everyone has enough power. Like if we start from the everyone has enough power to survive or whatever's goal, it's a very simple goal. And whereas I feel like the current goal and the goal of the system, which nuclear someone plays into, is the idea of we must continually raising the power to match raising demand. And there's nothing we can do to control demand. It's just not a part of what we're doing. You know, it's in the line in the contracts that we're still writing right now, we make the point that it's a very consumer supplier producer relationship in this sort of right now. Which is that we produce as much as we can consume because selling is good. We want to sell more. Whereas when you move towards a more grid management system, and the goal is to ensure that everyone has enough, and everyone is good, and within renewable energy and stuff like that, you're in a much different system. And that system, suddenly reducing your demand is just as valuable as producing more. And because the only goal is that everyone is happy. Instead of this idea of selling.
It's meeting needs.
Exactly.
And there's both of those things are variables.
Yeah.
That's the big misunderstanding. Both of those things are variables. How much energy we need and how much energy we produce are both variables. One of them is not fixed. Mm-hmm. Needs are not fixed. And the other one is a variable. They're both variables. And we can impact both of them. And any movement in either one is just as useful. And we're having a one-sided conversation. As usual, only one side of the equation is being looked at. All right. And we'll be back in the bonus show with more. So if you're listening on the podcast, we'll be right back. Other than that, have a good green week, folks. Listening to the Green Majority from Brenna, Stefan, and Darren. Have a good green week. And we'll see you all real soon.